Okay, that's the gold that I want for like our little opener.
What?
Have you not been listening to the episodes? Of course not.
You want people to know that my reaction when you're like, let's do a podcast, and I'm like, not now, I'm moisturizing.
Yes, and I want people to hear the sounds of you moisturizing.
Can you hear that?
Yes.
That's literally my skin. So I'm like, I bought this stuff at the... No, don't make fun of me, right?
So last week they did... Elena Smith, the costume designer and the production designer, did like a talk with the Houghton Library where they talked about like producing the show. And I watched it, and at one point towards the end, Elena Smith was talking about like... She was sitting with a bunch of Dickinson scholars, and they were all just like who work at the or at the Dickinson Museum. And they were all just sitting around drinking cocktails and talking about Emily Dickinson. And yeah. She sat there and was like, I love this crazy bitch. I was just like, that's how I feel. I love this crazy bitch.
that's such a mood. That's like, mm-hmm. That's us. I wish that is us. Like, hello everyone. You are listening to Edicts on Edicts,
a podcast about Emily Dickinson, but now she fights. Welcome to season three. We made it.
Yes, season three. It's been very exciting. We are. I was very excited for the beginning of season three of Dickinson. Mm-hmm. I have to say, season two was. It was much better than season one.
I was like, season two was good.
It was legit, hands down, like good solid entertainment.
Yeah, I enjoyed it top to bottom. Well done, Dickinson team.
Season three is quite exciting
as we dive into the Civil War.
The Civil War as well. Like, this is another thing where I feel like you're gonna have to talk me through so much because I just never learned about the Civil War in school. I mean, I learned about the War of the Roses, right? Which is like our equivalent.
Oh, the basis of Game of Thrones, a TV show I will never watch.
But we don't learn about like the American Civil War.
Right.
Even though I feel like the American Civil War is a lot more, dare I say, iconic.
Consequential.
Excuse me? Consequential? The fucking War of the Roses. Never mind. Okay, fine. Right. But the War of the Roses was very important to Europe, Kyle. I have to tell you that much.
Well, America finally ended slavery as a result. So,
yeah, well that's true. I mean, that's fair enough. Overt
institutionalized slavery. We still have a long ways to go. let's be real.
Wow. Yeah, let's not talk about modern day first world slavery.
We're starting this episode off lightheartedly. As we always...
Kyle, what is the title of the episode?
Thank God. So this is episode one of season three, the final season of Dickinson. Hope is the Thing with Feathers, written by Elena Smith and directed by Silas Howard. The two creatives behind the incredible Split the Lark episode, which I have shown to multiple people at this point, and they're always like, what?
You told me that. You said that you showed it to Ken, and I have to say, in my head, I was like, I think without context, it would be much less impactful.
It's just, you know, either you go for it and you're like, yeah, okay, or you're like, what the fuck is this? I don't want to watch it. Which Split the Lark has like a 75% hit rate where people are into it. And by that, I mean, I've shown it to four people and three of the four were into it.
Poor Ken.
And one was kind of confused and was just like, oh.
I think also, though, that episode, I mean, I don't want to spend forever talking about Split the Lark, no matter how good it is. But I would also say that I think that that episode has a very particular appeal for people that work in the entertainment business or the kind of production.
Sure.
Because a lot of it is about the stage and what it's like, the what's real and what's...
And just what it means to illusion. Make this your job. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think that you are of the ideal target audience for that, I would say, Kyle.
This is for me. Interesting. Wait, before we move on from Split the Lark, I just want to say, knowing that this is the final episode or the final season of the show, if you actually sit down and map out the whole show, Split the Lark is dead center. Like, it is the turning point of the entire show, which is fascinating.
That's very interesting.
Yes.
So it's the fulcrum.
It is. I'm just like, did they do that on purpose? Did they always know? I don't know.
We'll have to wait and see, won't we? But we'll have to see whether or not there is a kind of three series architecture.
I think there's going to be.
Yeah, well, there may. I mean, I hope there is, just because I think it'd be interesting. Could you give us a play-by-play of the episode for the folks at home who are too cheap to pay for Apple TV Plus?
I would love to. So we start out, as each season starts out, with a slideshow complete with Sue's voiceover discussing Emily Dickinson's Civil War period, which, as we've discussed previously, is her most productive period of her life. The American Civil War goes from 1861 to 1865. So it's a 4-year period where Emily is cranking out poem after poem after poem.
Right.
And it sort of ends with this question of people doubt whether Emily has the power, like, is a voice with the power to speak for a nation, which I think is going to be our sort of question over the course of the season. Is Emily the American poet? We then cut into a battlefield where Emily Dickinson is dressed in a Union Army uniform and charging across the battlefield into her desk to write a poem. And then we cut to the funeral of Lavinia Norcross. R.I.P. Lavinia, one of my favorite, like, recurring characters in this show. We have
the carriage with Death.
We have a scene with Wiz Khalifa as Death again, where he is discussing how bored he is with the Civil War, and he's wondering when this will end. The family comes back to Amherst. Emily and Sue have a cute scene together in the bedroom because they are now a couple?
Yeah, there's some kind of, we'll have to talk about that.
Yes, I was like, it's deeper than just where they've been before, so it's interesting. Then we move on to, I guess, the reception for the funeral, where most people are there just for the scones, not for Lavinia. I would show up to somewhere for good scones, if let's be real.
I mean, what else is there to do in wartime apart from, like, go to funeral wakes and eat free food?
Yeah, true. Lots of widows out there making scones in 1862. Austin is gross now. And then Mr. Conkey proposes to Emily in what I think is probably the comic highlight of the episode.
One second. I love that you just, like, skimmed over the Austin stuff with, like, he's just gross now. We're going to come back to that.
Again, I'm glossing over all of this because we're going to do this in detail. Quit interrupting my summary. I'm bad
sorry,
at this
sorry. I'll let
is.
You get on. I'll let you get on. I just think that the listeners love to hear my voice. That's all.
They're constantly wondering, where's Ben? And then we have the dinner scene, which I think is set up in direct parallel to the dinner scene from the pilot, where the family gets into an argument, but now a lot of those roles have been switched around. And it ends with Mr. Dickinson collapsing to the floor, Sue possibly going into labor, and Austin singing the Star Spangled Banner over his possibly dying father. So, what a note to end on.
Because I felt like last season ended on a relatively positive note for the entire family, is what I felt like.
Yes.
For the most part. Like,
with a sense of foreboding.
Yes. But for the generally speaking, at the end of season two, they seem to have reached more solid footing.
Yes.
After, like, a long period of doubt. But then this episode just takes that and is like, nope,
sets,
like,
it on
everything
fire.
Everything has gone to crap. And I almost think, like, I mean, we can talk about this more when we get to the end, but I almost think, like, the end of season you can almost think, like, imagine if the war had never happened and then the trajectory of the end of season two had continued. Mm-hmm. Maybe they would have just been happy.
But there still had to be some instability entirely because, like, Sue is Austin's wife and Emily is her lover.
Fucking his wife.
Yeah. So, like, something was going to... And I feel like we had talked, I think, at the end of season one about how this... the next season could be about war, and we just sort of jumped over the Fame season, which I think was essential to Emily, but also, like, here we are, this is the war season, get ready.
Yeah, if we go talk through it a little bit. So I love the opening slideshow, as usual. I find that's very, and there's a wonderful quote here to kick things off, which I'm sure you will have things to say about. It's the quote where Ella Hunt, who plays Sue, is obviously talking about Emily's prolific period during the war, and she says that it's described as a great and classic descent into a personal inferno.
Oh, yes. I have thoughts.
And this is obviously a clear allusion to Dante's Inferno.
Yes.
Which is one of my favorite classics, Dante's Inferno.
I definitely have started listening to an audiobook of it because, like, so for listeners at home, I started working on a script about two people descending into the underworld independent of this. And so, like, the second the Inferno showed up in this season of Dickinson, I was like, oh, I'm doing this.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, how some things, I think people talk about, like, zeitgeist, but I think some things, I'm a believer in the collective unconsciousness, and I think sometimes things recur within the collective unconsciousness or kind of float to the top of the communal pond, as it were.
Yes.
And perhaps in a way where we've had this kind of year and a half of chaos with the COVID-19 pandemic and everything, Dante's incredibly introspective work, which reflects immense amounts of suffering and hope, is quite pertinent.
Yes. Well, because that's the thing that as soon as they mentioned it, I thought about the inscription on the entrance to hell is abandon all hope, ye who enter here. And this season is sort of setting up hope versus despair. And obviously this episode in particular is built around the image of hope and what that is. Because I think we sort of have a naive idea of what hope is. I think hope is easily confused with optimism, which is like, things are always going to turn out great.
And I think that is the central tension for Emily of the episode, right? Mm-hmm. So we start with the funeral of Aunt Lavinia.
Yes.
And whereas everyone else seems to be kind of mourning, it's quite funny, really, because there's this whole thing of the priest kind of finding out that it's not a soldier, it's just an old lady, and then being like, I don't have time for this. And I love it when it's like, Lavinia, nor cross, she married her cousin.
That's so hard. Like, every line out of Jane Krakowski's mouth in this episode made me laugh real hard.
Yeah, it's so funny, some of the things she says. Like when Emily's like, look, listen, I can hear her spirit. And she's just like, Emily, please, not now.
Not now. As she looks at that little bird.
So Emily seems to have this kind of mystical experience where she thinks that the spirit of Lavinia Norcross is speaking to her through this little bird and telling her to basically be optimistic, right? To have hope. And throughout the rest of the episode, Emily keeps insisting everything will be fine. Like, every challenge that she's confronted with throughout the episode, she's like, it'll be okay.
Everything's fine. Yeah.
Like, everything will be fine. Like, it's all going to be great. And she clearly says that she feels that it's her responsibility to do that and be that and say that. Is that really what hope really is?
Right. I think that's one of the central questions, not just of the episode, because I have watched the episodes that have come out so far. And I think it is going to delve a little deeper into this question of hope.
We can discuss that as we go through the season. I think there's so many different ways to think about the concept of hope.
Just knowing that they're going to deal with the Inferno, like they're clearly questioning what hope is, because to abandon hope in order to enter the Inferno. The note that I wrote myself in like the weeks before these episodes came out as I was starting work on this short was like, in order to come out of the underworld, you have to choose to enter it.
And I was just so like, this is, yes. Yeah, and I think that's something that is the message of, obviously this is getting very deep already. Let's now go. For this, but.
Welcome listeners to hell.
Yeah, this is welcome to hell, yeah. Emily, you said it yourself, like Emily potentially is confusing hope for optimism.
Yes.
In this episode. Mm-hmm. But if we look at Dante's Inferno, or Dante's Divine Comedy as a whole, right?
As there's three parts. Pieces. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso.
Yeah.
In order for Dante to ascend the mountain into paradise to meet Beatrice, he first has to descend the all circles the of hell.
Yes. So there's actually a long lineage of this, as I have done my research for the script. It's the Catabasis and the Anabasis.
Yes, Catabasis, yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm an American. But so the Catabasis is the descent, and the Anabasis is the ascent.
Yeah,
and so Dante actually has to do one in order to do the other.
Yeah, it's actually potentially one of the oldest human myths that exist, because it goes...
This the Catabasis
goes back to ancient Babylon, in that you have the story of Gilgamesh, who descends into the underworld in his quest for immortality.
Yes.
The other really, really famous example is the story of Persephone.
Of course. I think the thing that spurred this was my love of Hades Town.
Yes.
And that is, you know, the classic entrance and leaving the underworld.
For my degree, I did ancient Greek religion. Mm, yes. And one of the areas that I really looked at was mystery cults in and around Athens. Mm-hmm. There was a very strong mystery cult that was devoted to Eleusis, or the Eleusinian mysteries, which was the... And we don't really know what was involved in this mystery cult. But what we know about it from sources and from the archaeological evidence is that it involved a symbolic descent into the underworld for initiates, and then a symbolic rebirth.
Right.
And it was done through Demeter, the earth goddess, and her daughter Persephone.
Yeah.
As symbols of death and rebirth.
Interesting.
So it's really one of the oldest human...
Yeah. Well, because I'm writing mine about a Japanese version of it all. And the mountain that I'm using has this like history of stories of death and rebirth happening on the mountain as well. Mm. And there's like caves underneath it. And it sort of sits in this volcanic caldera that's like got hells boiling up around it. And so, yeah.
But even
I was so curious, like how all of human society all over the world has come up with the same story of like entering hell and coming out of it changed.
But you see, it's even in the most primordial things. If we go back to the very root of language, and we're talking about, so the word for deity comes from the Indo-European root for diwos, which literally refers to the bright sky, the stars in the heavens.
Oh, interesting.
And mountains, the peaks of mountains were seen as the place where you would find the diwos.
Yes.
Right? Because you are literally getting physically as close as you can.
As you can, yeah.
But then there's almost the reverse of that. In that there's all the low places of the world as well. So primordial humans would find these caves and would find these subterranean environments. And to them, that is literally the underworld.
Right.
And the grave tumuluses, the like round hill graves mm-hmm. that you can find in most human cultures, where and you know, the later developments into like subterranean catacombs.
I was about to say Egyptian, like the Valley of the Kings.
Exactly. And yeah. So the underworld isn't like some theoretical place right. that only exists. And the heavens also aren't just some theoretical place that might exist. They are physically things that humans...
like they saw, and they would try to get closer to or get further away from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Interesting. But I wanted to just add to that discussion and say, even for us modern people, if you look at Christianity, mm-hmm. before Christ could ascend into heaven, first yeah. he had to
go into hell.
Yeah, and in theory, according to kind of Catholic mythology, mm-hmm. he was in hell for 3 days and three nights.
Yes.
You know, and did the harrowing of hell, where he went down and saved the pagan souls in hell. So this is something that just like recurs and recurs and recurs. Mm-hmm. And I think it recurs so much because it accurately reflects
what we see.
Yeah. And also the internal process of growth and maturity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why like every heroic story features a catabasis, where the hero has to perform a descent of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's like not into the underworld, it might be a failure of some kind,
that they have to recover from. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like some deep personal low point.
Yes.
Yeah.
A failure.
So that's just, I think it's really interesting, and you are completely right in that. If we're going to have a discussion of hope over the season, then mm-hmm. its opposite, despair, mm-hmm. Is just as important.
Which is like both feature in Emily's poetry throughout her life.
Mm. I mean, especially when we come to talking about death. I mean, mm-hmm. so she has this scene with death where she gets in his carriage. And like in real life, real OG Emily, there's so much despair around death in her poems, I think, and around grief, you know?
I will say, like, I think Emily, the OG Emily, was smart enough to separate the two, because she has that poem that starts with, "It was not death, for I stood up," and it ends with despair. So she acknowledges that the two are separate, even though they feel like one another.
No, I don't think she thinks death is purely... yes. despair. A bad thing.
Yes,
no.
Yes. Wait, before we move on to the death scene, can we just acknowledge, I just wanted to acknowledge the battle scene that opens the episode is fucking cool.
Like, no, it's, oh, see, I didn't like it.
You did? Oh, what is...
I didn't like it.
I'm sorry. The thought of Emily Dickinson in a Union Army uniform doing a barrel roll across the battlefield, I was just like... this show.
I cannot be convinced that writing poetry is the same as walking across a bullet-strewn battlefield. Like
this season is going to try.
I'm sure it is. It's got its work cut out for it, though, because in my heart, I am not a poet. I'm very practical, and I don't think that's an equal equation. But
of course, okay.
I did enjoy watching Hayley Steinfeld wearing the uniform and running, and like I liked it. I thought it was good. But I, you know, give or take it, you know,
We'll see if the season will sell you on is she a warrior?
Is she a war poet? The question.
Is she a war poet?
I mean that's something else I think for I'll say for like British listeners and for British,
because
a lot of the poetry in the late 19th and early 20th century in Britain is explicitly war poetry.
Yes.
And it becomes a canon of its own almost to talk, you know, we talk about poets on one hand and war poets on the other.
Yes.
And so I think, I don't know what it's like for Americans, but I think for Brits, the idea of someone being a war poet has very specific connotations with battlefield experience, or kind of firsthand experience of conflict.
I feel like this is a conversation for a later episode.
Yeah, I think so too, but it's interesting. Mm-hmm. So she has this scene with Death. Yeah, yes. And Death is like really depressed, and he...
Wiz Khalifa says he feels like shit.
Yeah, which, you know, love it. He says he's bored because everyone just dies the same way now.
Yeah.
And what I find really interesting is like, Emily is super positive here, you know?
Yes. To the point of possible delusion, being like, oh, I don't know if my life's that boring. Girl.
Yeah, he's like, your life is really boring and you still manage to remain positive. How do you do it?
Interesting. Yeah.
And her answer is that she almost like lays out a mission statement, doesn't she?
Yes.
Because she says, like, I believe that poetry can help people heal.
More powerful than death.
Yeah. And she says, like, helping people heal, helping them survive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she says, death can tear them apart, poetry can put them back together again.
And I could feel your eyes rolling across the planet.
Quite the contrary, Kyle. I disagree.
Oh my God, I do not know you.
Because go back to Orpheus and Eurydice. What was the one thing that could convince Death to let go of someone? It was poetry.
Yeah.
So, like, it's a deep. Emily's not wrong. Like, yes. You know, if you had to go for, and I think it's that whole death and art.
Mm-hmm. They stand in opposition to each other,
or they are brothers. One might say.
Yeah, this is the scene that I actually paused the episode and sent you that message of, like, I don't think I can be entirely objective about this season. Because, like, so last month, oh my God, I'm just gonna spill all my guts out on this podcast. What is it for if for not spilling my guts out?
We all need to know your personal details, Kyle.
Exactly. Everything. No, last month I shot a short film that I had the script for like 2 years that had just like sat in a drawer. Mm. And I made the note to myself again, well in advance of this season, that I was just like, if I'm going to make this thing, it has to be for more than just me. Like, it has to have something that I think is larger than like the work itself. And so right. I employed almost exclusively women and queer people as the crew.
That's a good start. I like it.
Yeah. And no, that was just, I just made the note to myself that like, it has to be for something larger than myself. And then this scene happened and I was like, well, fuck. Like, I'm just Hailee Steinfeld as Emily Dickinson.
Trying to be super positive and make the world a better place.
Actually, kind of, yeah. But yeah, so that's me being dumb optimist, thinking I can make the world better through art.
Well, maybe people do make the world better through art. Mm. Who knows?
Maybe.
She says, Emily also says, I want to be the little bird. That's what she tells Death.
Yeah. While I'm here, I want to do something that matters.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of Emily putting out her mission statement. What she sees is her mission statement for the season.
For the season, yes.
And I think that bubble is going to get burst at some point.
Oh, yeah.
And then they get home. She gets home. And, like, I love it because Lavinia, who is my favorite character, she's like, it was a lovely ceremony. And Mrs. Dickinson's like, stop gaslighting me. Which made me laugh so much.
So funny.
And then I also absolutely love, I thought that Jane Krakowski was on top form because I absolutely loved the bit where Sue arrives and Sue's like, oh, I really need to lie down. And Mrs. Dickinson's like really giving her a hard time for not going to the funeral, right?
Yes.
And Emily's like, oh, like I'll just take her upstairs and she can lie down. And then Mrs. Dickinson's like, no, that's rude.
That's rude.
I just love the idea that this is like really heavily pregnant lady. The socially acceptable thing to do is clearly to let her lie down.
Yeah.
But Mrs. Dickinson's like, you are not the mother of my grandchild. You are my annoying daughter-in-law.
Yes.
And you're going to stand here and you're going to welcome guests to my dead sister's wake.
I was like, I wrote the line of a woman's job is to make sure everyone feels great all the time, always, no matter how they feel.
Right, it's no matter the cost. No matter the cost. She's like, no matter the cost.
And there's Mrs. Dickinson's mission statement for life.
Yeah. And what I love about that is that when she says that in the scene, Lavinia is sat behind her and she has this like really shocked look on her face.
There's a point where like Lavinia, like Anna Baryshnikov almost cracks. Like it's out of focus, but she almost cracks.
She's like, how can you not with Jane Krakowski's out there saying these things? Like, it'd be so hard to be like, to take it seriously.
So difficult. So good.
But Sue does get taken upstairs and she and Emily have like some time in the bedroom together. They have like a kind of romantic, ambivalently romantic scene, I would say.
Yes. It's a tricky scene to sort of navigate because like they're both clearly attracted to each other and they both clearly have a connection, but there is a bit of disconnect happening for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, and I they do a really good job of portraying that kind of disconnect, but I couldn't put my finger on exactly what it was. And in a way it was really weird, but I almost got the sense that Emily was kind of grossed out by the pregnancy aspect of it. Well, and it's almost like that thing of like the baby is like a constant reminder of Austin.
Yes.
Who is the thing that is literally between them, if you see what I mean.
Like literally between them. Yeah, I see Sue's pregnancy belly. It's huge. I did spend some time wondering like, holy shit, do women get that? Like I have a lot of friends who are pregnant because of the pandemic times, not because of during. I think it did kick off some instinct in a lot of hetero people's brains of like pregnancy now.
Yeah, it's weird how that happens, isn't it?
Yeah. But Emily does have that line of pregnancy makes you hotter. It's kind of messed up. So there is like a physical attraction, but I think they're both coming at their relationship from two different angles. And if we sort of look back at season two, which they're seen together in the first episode sets off their course of exploration over the season, which like is Sue expressing that the poems are too powerful and Emily wanting to share them with her. Like in this scene, we have Sue saying she wishes this baby were Emily's and Emily saying that she never wanted children in the traditional sense and that her poems are her children. And so I wonder how these two will navigate that over the course of the season, because that is a fairly big wedge to put in between people who clearly love each other.
I mean, what stood out for me the most from the scene, to be honest, was the bit where Sue said that she has no fear, a strange sense of peace, and that she's the happiest she's ever been. And the reason that stood out to me so much is because a large part of season two was Sue expressing her fear of having children, but also kind of acting out of her loneliness
and grief.
And then it's almost like that whole thing of like, sometimes when you do the thing that scares you the most, you become the most at peace. Because in many ways, the thing that Sue's always wanted is a stable family.
Family, yes.
Like a stable, loving family. And even though she had all these fears about having a child, maybe having that child and having that connection to that child
will soothe that fear.
Yeah, and will give her the emotional, will fill the emotional need that she has been bandaging over for so long. But yeah, the fact that she's so, and it so contrasts to Emily, because Emily has this kind of like forced optimism in the face of war
and
whereas Sue has like genuine peace and contentment, despite the fact that there's war happening around her. it's the two different forms of
contentment hope. Or hope, sure. Because I was surprised at later on in the scene with Betty, where she arrives to deliver the funeral bonnet, like Emily describes herself as feeling quite happy today. And this is after, you know, having the scene with Sue.
Yeah.
She expresses surprise at Sue feeling happy in her situation. And I think it is the difference of that forced contentment versus, like, has Sue already gone through her catabasis? Catabasis. I'll try to get it right.
No, it's a Greek word. Like, I might not be saying it right. Who knows?
To our Greek audience.
Yeah, please if you are better with ancient Greek than me, please write in and tell me.
Has she gone through it already?
Well, I think, you know, that's what I mean. Like, I think to Sue, mm-hmm. it's like, I often, like, if we want to look again at, like, the hero's journey and the idea of catharsis and things, often what's required is for the hero to realize to let go and to realize how little power they have, right? To surrender to destiny or a greater force.
Or fear or whatever, yes.
Yes. And, like, Emily is definitely not doing that. Like,
no.
This optimism of hers is a coping mechanism, and it's an attempt to remain in control of a terrible situation, which is a civil war.
Yes.
Basically. So something so much bigger than herself, and she wants to try and be like, we can be positive, we can overcome this. Like,
brighter days are ahead. Yeah.
Whereas Sue is like, everything has gone to crap.
Mm.
And I have no control of my own body. I have no control of my appetites. Mm-hmm. I have no control of, like, Sue doesn't have control of anything. The only thing that matters to her is not the only thing that matters, but like her whole realm of influence has, like, shrunk right down to this baby, right?
Yes.
And I think that has given her
peace.
Yeah, peace.
Yeah.
Because she can't do anything. What's she supposed to do about the fucking war, you know?
Right. Like, she can't do shit.
And everyone's
about that.
Like, yeah, and like throughout the episode, everyone's asking each other their opinion about the war.
Mm-hmm.
But Sue just doesn't really have an opinion. And it's like, and she doesn't have an opinion on the family either, right? Everyone's like, at the end scene when Austin. They
diatribe. Yeah.
Yeah. And they all have, like, they don't all say things, but, like, Mr. Dickinson talks about the family. Emily talks about the family. Austin talks about the family. But the whole time Sue's like, can I eat yet?
Just eat this carrot, please.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, she just doesn't give a fuck. Like, and that's what gives her this sense of peace. Right.
Mm.
So that's what I found. I was like, I want to channel Sue for my life.
Oh, see, I feel like I'm deep in Emily territory.
See, I think maybe I just need to get pregnant, Kyle, and then and then I'll be fine. I just need to, someone just needs to knock me up.
Just have a baby.
Just have a baby. It solves everything, clearly.
All of my married hetero friends' thought process. If I just have a baby, this pandemic will calm down.
It will go away.
Oh, calm it. Meanwhile, I'm like, I will make a movie. And the movie will fix the world.
Definitely you are the Emily in this scenario.
Very clearly the Emily. Yes.
But after, like, yeah, so that's that interaction, I think, between Sue and Emily, really. Austin comes as
my notes say. And as I said earlier, Austin is gross now.
Would you like to elaborate on that for me?
Yes, so Austin arrives, and we get, again, Jane Krakowski killing it with, like, I may have lost a sister today, but at least I have a perfect son.
Yeah, and again, Lavinia's behind her is like, what the fuck are you talking about? Fuck?
As he brings that, like, wilty, inappropriate bouquet of, like, just gross flowers that it looks like he harvested on the walk over.
Yeah.
And we have the scene between Mr. Dickinson and Austin where he's sort of, you know, obstinate to all of his interventions, as Mr. Dickinson talks about, like, you remind me of my father who became a drunk. And again, in the pilot, Mr. Dickinson discusses like his fear of Emily ruining the family name that he worked so hard to restore after his father destroyed it.
Yeah. And I think if we bear that in mind, it does explain a lot of his Mr. Dickinson's behavior. Yeah. I mean, like, could you imagine growing up with, I mean, like I grew up with parents who were clinically depressed and like the level of responsibility. And I've through when I was doing social work, I've known a lot of people who their parents were alcoholics or drug addicts. And so from a very young age, they had to be responsible for their parents' behavior.
Right.
And a lot of those people become control freaks because they have to be.
Yes.
Right. To manage.
To fix things. Yeah. Or not fix, but to manage, you're right.
And so Mr. Dickinson's kind of disciplinarian, trigger happy temper makes a bit more, I'm not justifying it, but I'm saying it makes more sense when viewed through the lens of like his father was an alcoholic.
Right. And you figure like he, there's almost a sense of like, I restrained myself so that you guys could have a better life. And this is what you're doing with it. Like, this is what you're doing with the sacrifices that I made.
Because Mr. Dickinson consistently talks about how he's had to rebuild the family business and kind of rebuild the family reputation. And from his perspective, you can kind of understand it, right?
Because like he's doing.
Because like, look at Austin and Sue have like a sham marriage. His oldest daughter's like
Emily Dickinson.
Is Emily Dickinson, which like, as we've said, a crazy bitch. And then Lavinia is like kind of unmarried and kind of hanging around. And bless her. Like, she's just, at least Emily has the decency to have some charisma, right?
It's interesting. I was talking about this with Graham. Over a message where we were just saying like Emily is at least has like the discipline and the focus to work on something like her poetry. Whereas like we've discussed previously that like Lavinia is equally creative, but she doesn't necessarily have the discipline to focus. So as a result, she sort of ended up aimless, not just in her creative endeavors, but also just in her life. So she's,
and I feel, and I think that's probably why she's my favorite character, because I relate to that very strongly. Like, I feel like I have no purpose or aim or like focus. And I mean, I think because Mr. Dickinson makes his peace with Emily being a poet, right?
Yes,
like he's accepted
that. Yeah,
but I think everyone still hopes that Lavinia will just get married and kind of go off.
A normal life somehow. Spoiler alert, that doesn't happen.
It's kind of, it is a bit tragic though, because, well, anyway, we'll get to that.
I was like, we'll get to that.
And Mr. Dickinson in this scene also shows the first signs of illness. And when did Mr. Dickinson die?
It's quite a bit later. It's
you don't
not,
think they'll take creative license during, and...
Well, I mean, who knows what'll happen? We are in the final season. And this is the other thing which I was going to wait a little longer to discuss, but like Emily routinely says, like, I need to be here for my family throughout this episode. And like that kind of is her guiding force for a lot of the rest of her life after this point, where it's the poetry, it's Sue ? And it's her family, because after her parents die, she doesn't live too much longer.
No, she very much becomes her parents' primary carer.
Yes.
In their late life. In many ways, you also get, I also get the feeling that as Lavinia didn't marry, and as the parents kind of got into their inverted commas dotage, Emily kind of de facto became the matriarch.
Yes. I get that. Well, because she's making food a lot of the time. She's taking care of the house a lot of the time.
Yeah. She kind of seems to set the agenda. And Sue and Austin have their own household.
Yes.
But Emily obviously comes to be the caretaker for her father's household.
Dickinsons.
For the Dickinsons, which I think is really interesting because, you know, we think of her as someone who never got married, never had a family, but mm-hmm. in many ways she was almost like a wife to her whole family.
Yeah. And her poems are her children in some form.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like she understood that that was going to be her legacy. Yeah. Here we are. So we have the dichotomy of the family dichotomy of the season sort of set up in this scene with Austin and Mr. Dickinson.
And also let's talk about Lavinia a little bit because yes. There's this lovely bit where obviously the other Amherstians enter.
I love their entrance. There's one for every season and we got it.
I was going to say like, the most obvious one, obviously I think is a callback to Wild Nights.
Yeah.
But yes, they do have this kind of way of like entering like that. I love how the like minister husbands just kind of like shuffling around the back.
They're like an afterthought. Like, oh yeah, we're here too.
We're here too. Like we got married. Like
Jane's still a widow. Jane's
still a widow. Yeah. I love that. I love that for her because it's clearly worked for her, but
her delivery after Lavinia talks about like the death of the two men that she cared about. Jane's just like, I get it, girl. I'm a widow.
I'm a widow.
She like looks around the rooms to remind everyone.
Yeah. There's that great bit where they're all stood around talking about like the Civil War and like how awful it is. And there's two things that really stood out to me. So the first one is like when Mr. Dickinson come, they're like, oh my God, like it's awful. Why did this have to happen in our 20s? And then Mr. Dickinson comes in and he's like, yeah, like if this had happened to me in my 20s, I would have killed myself. And like the reason that really stood out to me is because like, oh my God, that's such a boomer thing to say.
It totally is.
Like 100%. Like I'm in my 20s now, right? Like I'm 27 and like this pandemic has kind of meant that I feel like I went from being 25, 26 to being 28, like in one.
Oh my,
because I'm 28 in less than a month's time.
Go away.
I'm like, no, but listen, hear me out. I feel like I just like jumped that gap, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like older generations, either they're like, you've got it too easy, or they're like, oh, it was so much better when we were younger.
Right.
Yeah. There's no middle ground. It's one of the, it's either everything is too easy for young people.
Wow. Or, everything is awful.
Yeah. And it was so much better when we did it.
Yeah. I will say when Lavinia said that mentally, I was like, Emily's 32 this season. Thank you. again, I'm which the also Emily. Like
she's which, you know, is a good old age. Like and they've reflected that in the wardrobe choices, haven't they? I mean,
you calling her old, like Mr. Conkey.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, for the time period. No, like they reflected that in the costume choices as well, because Emily seems to be wearing a lot more. Her hair styles and her clothes seem a lot more like mature
up. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I was going to say, like, they actually look a bit like how the same characters look in A Quiet Passion.
Yes.
Like, they've actually kind of reached that point.
That period.
Yeah, which is unnerving.
All right, so we are discussing Lavinia.
Yeah, so basically there's the revelation that, what's his name, has died.
Joseph Lyman.
That's it, Joseph Lyman, thank
from
you.
From season one.
And I love that, like, Jane just, like, casually mentions it. As if it's like no big thing. She's like, oh, I was chatting to so-and-so the other day and he mentioned that so-and-so had died. And Lavinia is just like, like scream. And like, that's why one of the things, again, like I love about the character of Lavinia is just like,
girl she doesn't expresses try her like, feelings.
Exactly. She's just like, straight away, she's just like, this is the most tragic thing that has ever happened to anyone. I just love it. It's great. It's interesting that this kind of triggers this reflection for Lavinia a little bit, I think, where she kind of reflects that all the men she could ever have married
are dead.
Are dead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, like you said, Emily's in her 30s, and I think it's like maybe it's a little bit like what I said last season of perhaps you get to a certain age and you look back and you think the choices I made in my 20s were the wrong ones. And then your 30s are about learning to live with the choices you made in your 20s.
Am I in that phase? Maybe. Oof.
And I think that's why so many divorces happen in the when you're in your 30s.
That makes sense, because you're like reflecting on, is this where I want to be and is this who I want to be with?
And you're like, I made this decision when I was in my 20s and I didn't know anything.
Yeah.
And now I'm in my 30s and I know so much more. And I don't want this for myself.
Or I don't know if it's necessarily that I know so much more or that like I have decisively changed from that person and I no longer want those things. Because, I feel like I don't know jack shit, but also that the person I was in my 20s is not the person I am now. So make of that what you will.
Yeah, yeah. Or perhaps it's more like you, again, like the whole Socratic thing of like, you know what you don't know now. And so you don't want to like pursue something which you've learned is not
within my interests.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We have, then we have the scene between, speaking of generational differences, we have the scene between Mrs. Dickinson and Emily, where Emily's trying to reassure her that like, there's people here. Look, your sister was loved. And Mrs. Dickinson's just saying like, the world we grew up in is lost and no one will ever remember my sister, which is kind of devastating. Like,
yeah, but it's that's it's the thing about war, isn't it? Like, it war, like if there's ever something that punctuates a generational divide so massively, it's it's war. I mean, look at Virginia Woolf, for example. Like, she's not a war poet or a war writer.
You don't think so?
I think, well, this is what I'm saying. So I think like she's not, but what she does write about and what she reflects in her work is this divide between the Victorians and the Edwardians.
Sure.
You know, yes. And so that is punctuated by the First World War.
Yes.
And the difference in, it's like the difference in costumes in Downton Abbey from the pre-war period to the post-war period.
Okay, sure.
Right? Like in the pre-war period, everyone's dressed like they're from bloody Victorian times. But then in the post-war period in Downton Abbey, Lady Mary's running around with trousers on.
She's
like,
put pants on and chaos reigns.
Exactly. Like, and in America, you have like the whole 1920s and like...
Yeah, the aftermath.
And I think Mrs. Dickinson's making this point of like, actually the world before the Civil War is gone.
It's gone.
And also, that was my world. That was the world of Lavinia Norcross Norcross.
Yes.
It's gone.
It's gone. And you have that, like that... Again, this sort of connects back to that line she had earlier about like a woman's job is to suppress her feelings and make everyone feel good no matter what. And that is like a mark of a prior generation, because like Emily, Lavinia, and Sue would not believe that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think we're in that period now?
I think the other thing, I think that war is one of those things that punctuates these generational divides. I think that pandemics are the other.
I mean, so you figure like, that the divide between the Edwardians and the Victorians that you point out had both. So
yeah, exactly. Spanish flu, but also think about the difference between you know, you have the Black Death, right? And the period before the Black Death is called the Dark Ages.
Yes,
and then the period after the Black Death is called the Renaissance.
Like society itself has to enter a catabasis in order to emerge. Yeah.
That is literally it. Like there's that low point and then there's the peaks and the troughs and society transforms through these things. I think it will be really, I'm really interested to see when we're in our 50s, which touch wood, I will live till then. And touch wood, so will you.
But, yeah, I was like, I should do that too.
But like the, it'll be really interesting to actually see people who were born and grew up totally after the pandemic.
Yeah.
And whether or not there will be any significant difference, because what I think the pandemic has done is first of all, make death a little bit less taboo because it's just more present.
More of a thing that we acknowledge.
And also, weirdly, has kind of brought environmental concerns.
As it fucking should. Jesus Christ. Yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you wouldn't think that they would be directly related, but somehow the pandemic has kind of, I mean, I don't know about in Japan, I don't know about in the States, but here in the UK, like, suddenly there's a lot more discussion of the natural environment. And it's almost like people have said, oh, crap, like, the pandemic was really awful. And here's this other existential awful thing
looming over us.
And, like, maybe we need to start thinking about it so that we're not caught off guard in the same way that the pandemic has.
It would be nice because, man, it's coming. climate change is here. Like, we already did it.
But yeah, so I think like these things are massive. And so Mrs. Dickinson's right when she's like saying that no one's going to remember Lavinia Norcross because, and the other thing is just like, think of again, like the priest saying like, I mean, think of all the young people that die. Yeah. That's the other nasty thing about war is like a lot of young people die.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I know I don't want to be ageist. It's horrible when anyone dies, but there is a substantive difference between a lady who's in late middle age slash her waning years and a whole generation of young men dying,
I think there's, again, the pandemic has sort of brought up, at least to my mind, where, you know, a lot of Americans discuss like old people should get out there and sacrifice themselves for the economy. And I was like, holy shit. Like, we're listening to a bunch of sociopaths.
That's just horrible. And it's worth noting that unlike the Spanish flu, like this current pandemic has hit the elderly the hardest.
Right. So I think the other thing that I hope we get out of this is that like elderly people do have a role in our society, which is to teach us the things that they did so that we don't do them, or that we can respond in a way that is intelligent. But yes, there is a massive loss of young life at the same time. So I don't know. It's an interesting moment to be watching a story about Emily Dickinson and the Civil War.
I mean, the other thing I wanted to talk about just briefly is like, do you think that America, there's been so much civil upheaval in America, in the US at the moment. Do you think that another civil war could ever happen in our lifetime?
I don't know. Honestly, I hope not. We talk about being in like a cold civil war right now in America. And I worry about what would happen if anything were to set off that powder keg, because I think it could very easily happen.
Well, people talk about the culture war, don't they?
Yes. But I think it goes deeper than that at this point. Like, it's more than just like popular culture or like media consumption. It's gone so deep that it's like different versions of reality are governing different parts of the country. And I don't know how you pull it back from that.
Yeah. Well, I think especially with America, I mean, it's true here as well, but especially with America, what it means to be the USA varies so much from state to state. And the other thing is, it seems to me from the outside looking in that those different ideas about what it means to be American cannot coexist.
Right.
They are contrary to one another. And so that's a conflict that's just so, I don't know how that's going to be, addressed.
Just how we reconcile. That's what I mean when I say like, there's two different versions of reality and there's probably more, but like how we reconcile when you see the world completely differently, how do you coexist with one another?
Well, this takes us kind of to Mr. Dickinson's speech to the family.
Mm-hmm.
If, do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to finish talking about Emily's proposal?
We can talk about Mr. Conkey's proposal very briefly, which is a comedic highlight of the episode to me. I think Hailee Steinfeld's real funny in this as this like goofy version of Emily that we probably don't think of very much, but definitely existed. Like,
yeah, yeah. She's got, Emily has a weird, like, Emily, even from her poems, you can see that she had like a kind of,
she's goofy.
She was a bit of a hippie.
Yeah, she was. She was like she was funny. So I liked this scene. There's not too much to discuss here other than like, lol, Emily's not that old. And I did love him describing her as like a happy little bird bringing smiles to people's faces. And she's like, I'm pretty sure no one's ever described me that way, but okay.
Except that she described herself that way.
That's true.
Sort of at the beginning of the episode when she told Death, I want to be the little bird.
Yes.
So in a way, maybe the scene has a dual function because like it's funny, but also maybe it's kind of like hinting to Emily, like if you make yourself into this little bird, this is how people will perceive you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, this is the sort of response you're going to engender
from people. Yeah.
I was going to say, cause I mean, what do you do with pretty little birds? You put them in cages, don't you?
Put them in cages and listen to them sing endlessly.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I wanted to ask because it's sort of, you know, the thread that they pull through the episode of this bird imagery and like hopes, because Mr. Conkey says it as like a cute little bird in a cage singing. And then in the dinner scene, we have Austin discussing like how Mr. Dickinson kept his children in cages and clipped their wings so they couldn't go very far. And sort of, I actually thought back to Split the Lark to bring that episode up again, where larks are sort of pulled through the episode. And this seems to be like a writing habit of Elena Smith's of like sort of taking the image and refracting it. She obviously didn't invent it, but like,
yeah.
Specifically around birds.
But I think Emily, that's a riff on Emily's,
oh yeah,
Emily's own obsession with birds.
Yes, for sure.
There's another link as well that you might find interesting, which is probably incidental, but in both Egyptian and Greek versions of catabasis stories, it's often the case that the human soul is depicted as a bird.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially for the Egyptians, but also for the Greeks, there's this long tradition of this belief that when someone dies, their soul takes on the form of a bird and leaves their body, if that makes sense, to venture into the next world. And then that extended to the point where birds were seen as psychopomps, a psychopomp being a kind of divine messenger who communicates between the world of the living and the world of the dead. So that's where we get the whole tradition, the folklore of things like owls traveling to and from the underworld and things like that. So yeah, it's just like a little note on like birds have a very specific, very potent relationship with death and with, yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
And now that you know that, just like whenever you look at like classical art and things like that, just note where you see birds and what they're doing, because it's often quite interesting.
So let's move to this dinner scene with Mr. Dickinson discussing this American family and can they coexist?
Yeah. So he literally says, and he says, our American family, this American family.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this goes back to our discussion of America now, the USA now, and how divided it is, even though it's one, you know, America is weird in terms, I think personally that America is quite weird in that, sorry, Americans, let me just clarify that, break that down a little bit. Like my country, Britain, for example, it was never really like founded, you know, it was just kind of like, there, and then this guy rocked up and was like, I'm the king of Wessex and I'm also now going to be the king of England. And some other guys were like, no, and he was like, yes. And there were a few wars, and then like eventually it just kind of organically turned into the Kingdom of Great Britain, you know, over like 1,000 years. But America's different because America, it's like some settlers rocked up, kicked out the locals, and then were like, we're going to make a country and we're going to plan it and we're going to have like a constitution and we're going to...
We're making rules.
Yeah, and we're going to have rules and we're going to have like a whole... We're going to have a system of governance that we have thought about. And so in that way, it's kind of like a grand experiment, isn't it? Like it's...
I mean, it's called the American experiment. So
right, there you go. So they, yeah. Yeah, so okay, I've not heard that before, but yes.
Oh yeah, no, it's a thing.
Right, okay, so that's interesting. So that's what I mean, like it's kind of like, whereas most countries just kind of organically happen,
emerge. But yeah,
I guess the point I'm making is like when the founding fathers found the USA, mm-hmm. and they set it up and everything, mm-hmm. did they ever foresee that
this division,
yeah, and it's almost like the Civil War is almost like siblings fighting.
It is.
Because culturally, yeah, obviously there are differences between the North and the South, significant differences, but they are also culturally, both sides are culturally American.
Well, I think the Founding Fathers, in many ways, knew that they had set up a broken system because they knew that like slavery and race were going to be a massive problem. And they just sort of kicked the can down the road being like, won't be alive to deal with this. And they weren't. By the time the Civil War rolls around, the Founding Fathers are way dead. And they sort of knew that they wouldn't have to deal with the issue. In many ways, the aftermath of the Civil War, when we enter Reconstruction, becomes a similar sort of kicking the can down the road in terms of actually dealing with that racial inequality, where we're on the cusp as a country of like actually addressing the issues and sort of working to fix centuries of like systemic inequality, and they kick the can down the road again.
Yeah.
So America has this habit of like coming to the cusp of dealing with its issues. And then, like Orpheus, turning around at the last second and fucking it up.
Yeah.
I wonder if we have it in us to actually face up to our problems and deal with them. So I don't know. Yeah. The Civil War is one in a series of us getting so close and missing that final step. And turning around.
Well, hopefully it won't require another great upheaval.
I hope so. I worry sometimes.
Mr. Dickinson clearly draws this kind of parallel of, as I say, like our American family, this American family. Mm-hmm. And then Austin continues that when, at the end of the fight, he says, I'm seceding.
I'm seceding from this family.
He says, I'm seceding from this family. So like he's gone rogue state.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like we're going to be the Dickinsons, but we're not going to be the same Dickinsons. We're going to have a different flag. And like, you know, well, instead of having like a north south divide, they've got like an east west divide along the main road of Amherst.
I was about to say, whatever the road is dividing the Dickinson house from the Evergreens.
Yeah. But yeah, so there's this clear parallel. And I think like, yeah. But then to go back to the bird thing, Austin also uses like a bird analogy because he says, you clipped our wings, you kept us in cages. He says that to Mr. Dickinson. And I just don't know how true that is, but you can see why Austin feels that way.
Well, it was interesting. Like, so one of the Emily Dickinson bios that I read, holy crap, Kyle.
Not where you thought you'd be at this stage in your life.
Not at all. Oh my God. But so I read My Wars Were Laid Away in Books, which was written by Alfred Habiger. I don't know how to say people's names, but he talks about how like Mr. Dickinson has all these letters where he is incredibly overprotective of his children. And there was a line in it about how he was like legitimately unsure if the Dickinson children ever saw snow growing up, or if Mr. Dickinson was so protective that he wouldn't let them outside because he was worried they would, you know, get sick. So that sort of seems to inform what's happening in this scene of that overprotection of Mr. Dickinson to the point where he's smothered his children's potential. And now they're sort of like living in the languish of that.
Hmm. Gosh.
Hmm. So that's,
maybe he did. Maybe he, like, we don't.
We talk about how, like, Emily thinks she had a positive relationship with her father and that it was her mother who had more issues. But I wonder, like, how objective could she be, you know?
Oh, I don't think Emily is very objective at all.
No,
about her father.
I don't think so.
Like, I think she really puts him on a pedestal.
Yes.
And I think in many ways that in itself is a reaction to grief. Like, it's very easy to deify someone once they've died. Happens so much with spouse, usually with spouses, right? People lose their spouse and their significant other.
They were perfect. They're my best friend. Yeah.
But it can happen with parents as well. But yeah, even during her lifetime, I think she was very like, it's interesting. I can totally imagine that a lot of Mrs. Dickinson's ambivalence about Emily probably actually came from the fact that Emily preferred Mr. Dickinson.
Oh yeah, you know? I can imagine it.
Probably didn't make their relationship any easier.
Oops.
And then you've got Lavinia, who just has like never been able to marry, but also has like never really lived up to either her parents' expectations or her own potential.
Right.
Which is quite crushing. And Lavinia is always in the shadow of Emily.
I was going to say, like, her life becomes subsumed by Emily. But I wonder, like, and I guess we could discuss this later, because I imagine the season will address the Lavinia-Emily relationship as they get older.
I hope so, because I think actually it's, I know that a lot of, we've focused a lot in the show on Emily and Sue, but I genuinely think like the most significant relationship in Emily's life must have been Lavinia, because they lived together.
They did
their whole life,
their whole lives,
and there was in theory nothing stopping Lavinia marrying. So what was it? What role did Lavinia play to Emily? And when Emily was isolating herself the way she did, Lavinia was perhaps her lifeline in many cases to the rest of the world. I mean, yeah. I didn't like, it was one of the few things I didn't like about Wild Nights with Emily, the film.
Yes. The portrayal of Lavinia.
Yeah. Where she's portrayed to be kind of like a bit in inverted marks special.
Yes.
Whereas in A Quiet Passion, they had this much more bright social Lavinia.
Who is in many ways Emily's equal in intelligence, if not in productivity or creativity. Yeah. And the show hasn't really given these two much together, you know? Like, I enjoy both of them as actresses, but as I was thinking about it, I thought that they don't actually do much together. Like, I don't think
they don't
really
have many scenes.
Time in season two.
No, I mean, they had the scene in the spa episode.
That's true. They do, where Lavinia says she's her hero.
But that's one moment in...
in a season.
In a season, yeah. And they've put a lot of emphasis on, as well, on Austin and Emily's relationship. Like, for a while, you very much feel that in the show, you feel that Austin and Emily have the closest bond. And it's Austin who sees Emily when she's
invisible.
Nobody, when she's invisible. But in many ways, like, who could relate to Emily more than Lavinia, I feel. So maybe, hopefully, the season will show them grow closer as this stage of their life progresses and they are left alone together. Because Sue is going to have her children, and I don't know whether they'll get to this in the show, but, you know, Sue has her children and her life. Whereas, and then the parents get old and elderly. So there would have been a period of time where Emily and her sister Lavinia were kind of like
each other's support systems. Like,
pretty much. Like, I was going to say, like, the only adults in the house.
True.
But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Is there anything else from the dinner scene that we want to talk about? I feel like it is interesting to have Austin rip the family apart out of frustration. And
I think that the three speeches kind of, I think in a way it's a bit of a bit of a Socratic, not a dialogue, but like a,
yes,
what's the word? Because like Mr. Dickinson poses a question in his monologue.
Yes.
Where he's like, can this American family be reconciled?
Endure, yeah.
Then Emily comes forward and makes her monologue, which is, yes, it can. We have to be hopeful. We have to be positive. Mm-hmm. And then Austin comes, kind of rebukes her with his monologue, which is, everything's gone to shit and we're not really a family and I secede and
this family hates each other.
This family hates each other and it's fake and he's, and it, and so I think that this kind of like this dinner scene poses the question about the Dickinson family and about America.
Yes.
And Austin and Emily give the two opposing responses.
Yes.
And then Sue's like, can I just eat?
I also love that they're casually naming the baby without any of Sue's input.
Yeah, they're like, we'll, we can call her Lavinia. And Sue's like, well, 1 second. But yeah, so that's what I think we can get out of that dinner scene going forward.
And then at the very end of the episode, as Mr. Dickinson is lying on the floor, Emily composes the first four lines of Hope is the Thing with Feathers. So shall we move on to the poem? So, hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.
It's a lovely poem, isn't it?
Mm.
This is the poem that Mabel Loomis Todd, the devil, put on the front cover of.
Oh, really?
What is what she? Well, her edition of Emily's poems was called "Hope is the Thing with Feathers."
Oh.
So I've got the Loomis Todd edition, and it's called "Hope is the Thing with Feathers." That's the name. That's the title of the book, and the front page. The like, what's the word? The title page. So for whatever reason, Mabel liked this one the best.
Yeah. I mean, I think this, it makes a certain sense for Mabel Loomis Todd to go for this one because it is perhaps her most universally appealing poem, if you confuse hope with optimism.
Yeah. And I think also that it has that through line of the bird, which is an image which recurs perhaps in Emily's poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so making it the title poem of the book perhaps suggests that where birds are mentioned in other poems, the subject is hope.
Yeah.
Or optimism, as you put it, or whatever.
If you're trite like Mabel Loomis Todd. Anyway, moving on. I'm so angry.
But it's a nice poem. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul. So the idea that hope lives within us.
Yes.
And sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And it kind of, and again, it when endures. She goes on and says,
yeah,
it endures. And she says, I think it's interesting when she says, and sweetest in the gale is heard.
And sore must be the storm. I like the personification of the storm as particularly bitter.
And I think where she's saying that, it's almost like the whole thing we were talking about, how sometimes you have to pass through really trying times. It's when things are at their worst and at their darkest that the song of hope is most sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And that this little bird, even though it's like a little bird, can sing even in those
darkest really, moments.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think that's, it's interesting in the final stanza. Again, we see that extremity. Literally, we see the word extremity, but like the chillest land and the strangest sea, that even in, like we've said, those darkest, most dire moments, hope is still there and particularly pronounced if you can find it, if you choose to hear it.
Yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.
Mm.
So this is a bit more difficult to pass, I think. perhaps that she's saying that hope only gives up to us and does not take.
It doesn't take.
It doesn't cost anything.
That it's similar to how people discuss creativity, actually, where creativity begets creativity. Like, hope begets hope. If you choose to listen to the song, like, it doesn't ask anything in return, but becomes perpetually recurring. It does not ask in return. It only gives.
Yeah, a lovely poem.
It's good. Again, I feel like I've had this sort of reconciliation of my own idea of hope over the past pandemic. to sort of wonder.
Just the most recent one.
Yeah, yeah. but yeah, what is it? What does it actually mean? Because I feel like, again, it's been reduced in social conversations to optimism, and they are different things.
To the Greeks, it was the greatest curse of man.
To hope.
Yeah. That's the whole myth of Pandora's jar, isn't it?
Yeah. Pandora's jar?
Yeah, like the actual Greek, it's a jar, not a box.
Oh, okay. Well, how about that?
Which makes more sense when you consider, like, the time period.
Pandora's amphora.
Pandora's amphora, literally, that is what it is.
Yeah.
That is the most accurate thing. Pandora had an amphora. And what did she keep in there?
I was about to say, can we employ Maggie to write a limerick about Pandora's amphora? There once was a woman named Pandora who had an auspicious amphora. She opened it up.
Oh, she opened it up and...
I got nothing.
No, I couldn't keep it. I'm not Irish enough.
I will, for the next episode, I will write a limerick about Pandora's amphora. So okay, look forward to
please
that.
Please do.
Yeah.
I just want to say that was my only real laugh out loud moment of the episode was when Maggie said, she's not grasping the urgency of the situation in regards to the spoons.
The spoons that need polishing.
And then when Mrs. Dickinson's like, I'm in a bottomless pit of despair. And Maggie's like, you've got a bottom, madam. We have to get it up out of this chair.
I even said, like, again, the show has grown up so much because the framing of Maggie in that shot is so fucking funny.
Like, oh, yeah.
Just her placement in the frame made me laugh. God, love this show. Oh, you've grown up so much. I'm so proud of you. I'm so glad we stuck with you for 2 years.
Focus. Okay.
Yes,
focus.
Yes.
So, second to last thing, kitty count.
Kitty
one
count.
For the season.
Plus one. Eating a pea.
Yeah, very cute. Love it. Yep. Thank you. Giving the fans what they want.
Yes.
Finally, how many loaves of bread?
Loaves of bread.
The episode. Yeah.
Oh, God. Again, I'm not going to be objective about this whole season moving forward. I already, like, have too many feelings. I'm going to give it 8.5. I know. I'm going to overrate the whole season again. It's fine. Deal with it.
I will balance it out.
Yeah.
With a 6.5.
Oof. Oof. Brutal.
It was a solid start. It was a solid start. It set the pins up. I just need to see them get knocked down now.
Oh, yes. No, I feel like between the solid setup of a lot of questions that this is going to answer and then, like, some solid comedy, especially from Hailee Steinfeld in that proposal scene, like, loved it. I laughed multiple times through the episode. Also, just Jane Krakowski, every line. God, what a treasure.
She is a national treasure to you, guys. Honestly, she is.
Walt Whitman, and that's end of list. And Emily. the American treasures list.
That's a very white list. I'm just going to say that now.
Oh, God, it's true. Oh, shit. Thank you for calling me out on that. I will. Okay, so I will write a limerick about Pandora's amphora and add some people of color to my American heroes list. Fuck. Oh no.
And on that note, everyone, thank you for listening to Edicts on Edicts. I've been Ben, and my co-host has been the lovely Kyle. And if you would like to contact us about anything that has been talked about on the show today, you can. We have an email address. It is edictsonedicts@gmail.com, all lowercase. We love getting emails. Kyle responds to all of them. I don't, because
with a long diatribe of my feelings at the moment.
You will get a small essay in return, I can assure you.
Letter writing is the best form of friendship.
It's how we've lasted this long. Thank you. Bye.